The title of the address is How and What We Remember. This year, once again, we laid a poppy wreath at the plaque in the hallway that commemorates five young men from this congregation who died in the First World War. The five deaths took place over a period of just 8 months. Two of the boys were brothers. They died just 5 days apart. And those are the photographs in the thing, the Perspex things on the table. A third was an only child. They were average age at the time of their deaths was just 23 years. And we lay our wreath in remembrance and in sadness at the loss of young lives and in protest against war as a solution to disputes. Two buzz phrases were popular at the time of that war. The first was the war to end all wars. The other was it will be over by Christmas. Both were lies. But some cliches are true. For example, history keeps repeating itself. History is written by the victors, and the first casualty in war is truth. Israeli leaders say that when Israel utterly destroys Hamas, Israel will have peace. In that, I hear echoes of the war to end all wars. Because war never creates peace. Only peace can replace war. Hatred is never conquered by hating in return. Light can only replace darkness. Love is the only solution to hate. History is written by the victors, and history keeps repeating itself. Are two cliches I experienced while researching for my address today. A few months ago, I was looking for children's stories, and I came across an account of the life of someone called Irina Sendler. I thought when I saw it, that's great, I can talk about Irina at our Remembrance Sunday. And the story of her life says a lot about those cliches. Irina Sendler was born in Poland in 1910. She lived until 2008, so she was 98. She had a terrific innings. Her father was a doctor who treated the poor and marginalized. He actually died from typhus contracted from a patient in 1917 when Irina was just 7 years old. And she did inherit her father's liberal humanitarian qualities. Some of the patients her father treated were from the Jewish people in the area who were the marginalized group in their town. I grew up with a version of history that said Adolf Hitler was the instigator and driving force behind the Holocaust. I believed that Nazism enforced Hitler's poisonous ideas throughout the conquered countries of Europe. Now, I was aware that there had been programs against the Jews from time to time, but I thought that they were intermittent, isolated, and really, to a large extent, historic. But researching the story of Irina made me realize that Hitler's plan for the Jewish solution, as it was called, was only pushing an open door. The door was wide open. Anti-Semitism was not the preserve of the Nazi regime during the war. Jews were expelled in 1290 from England by Edward I. In 1492, they were expelled from Spain. In 1493, they were expelled from Sicily. In 1561, Venice created the first ghetto. European history is a chronicle of anti-Semitism. Irina Sendler's social activism began when she was at a university in Warsaw, and she attended that university between the years 1927 to 29. Her first protest was against the proposed introduction of ghetto benches and quotas to limit the number of Jewish students in Polish universities. 1927 to 29, Hitler had not come to power. In 1931, a student group called the Green Ribbon Group began to agitate that seats be reserved for Jewish students and Jewishness be marked on student cards. The Nuremberg Laws of 1935 were an inspiration for the existing anti-Semitism alive in Europe. And in 1936, that's 3 years before the start of the war, the Polish government were in talks with Zionist groups in Palestine with a view to the enforced migration of 3 million Polish Jews to Palestine. That was before the war. With the outbreak of war, the Warsaw Ghetto was established in November-December 1940. And about 460,000, you can't be sure of these figures, but about that number of Jews was sealed into an area of 1.3 square miles. The average room occupancy was 9.2 persons. And they barely subsisted on meager food rations. Today, more than 2 million Palestinians are corralled into approximately 72 square miles, might be marginally less crowded than the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, but the Warsaw Ghetto wasn't bombed in 1940. I listened to a Palestinian woman speak on TV, and she said that she's living in a house, sharing it with 45 relatives. And like the Warsaw Ghetto, food supplies are being withheld, as is water and medical supplies. An awful tale of history repeating itself. And of course, the shining light is that some people risked not only their lives, but the lives of family members to help Jews. And the law was that if you were found in any way assisting a Jew, you were executed, as was your extended family. Irina Sendler was one such individual. Using her social work as a cover, Irina had access to the ghetto. She and fellow conspirators smuggled out almost 2,500 children in boxes and cases. They placed them with sympathetic Christian families in orphanages and particularly in convents. The children were given Christian names and identities, and they were taught Christian prayers just in case they were interrogated by the Gestapo, that they would be able to pass as Christian children. Irina kept careful note of the children's Jewish identity, the new Christian identity they were given, and where they were placed. And she did this because she wanted to reunite the children with their parents at the end of the war. But sadly, very few of them did manage to reunite with the parents. Most of the parents died. On the 13th of October 1943, Irina was arrested by the Gestapo. She managed to give her friend, for safekeeping, the jar with those details of the children on it, because had that jar been found, every one of them and all the people who were helping them would have been executed. And although she was tortured while in jail, she never betrayed any member of her group. She was sentenced to be executed, and the date set for her execution was the 13th of November 1943, which is 80 years ago tomorrow. She was being transported to the place of execution when she was rescued by the underground. They had bribed the guards escorting her. And to keep the ruse up on, her execution was publicly reported, and she was all the time in hiding until the war ended. After the war, she received many awards for her work. She is named among the righteous of nations in Israel. And she quite a colourful personal life. I love really good people who aren't real saints either. She married just before the outbreak of war, and her husband was taken prisoner of war in September 1939. So at the very beginning of the war, he was taken prisoner and spent the entire war in a prisoner of war camp, but he survived. They were reunited after the war, but 2 years later, in 1947, she divorced him, and she married a Jewish man that she had met in the Warsaw Ghetto. They had two surviving children, and he was a member of the Jewish community, but their children only learned that their father had Jewish identity as adults, accidentally, because they were very careful not to mention things like this. It wasn't important that you were a Jew or a Christian or whatever else you wanted to be. You were a human being first. And I think that's a lovely thing to teach, to bring children up like that. They were just people. Her second husband left her in 1957, and he died 3 years later. And she went on to remarry her first husband. 10 years later, she divorced him again. I loved that. But she went on to work with children right until her retirement, and she died aged 98. Since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, Jews from all parts of the world have settled in Palestine. And when you think of the history of the Jews in Europe, it's obvious why they want the security of their own state. But the creation of that state has caused a great deal of hurt to the Palestinians, citizens of that land, living there. Zionists, which we should distinguish from Jews, really they're very political minded, and they have the intention of settling everywhere in Palestine, where they take over the land from Palestinians, set up a settlement, and that is against international law. And yet international law are not doing anything about it. So it's very difficult for the Palestinians to be corralled into these areas and see people from a different tradition living on their land. So that gives us an understanding of what happened in October with those murders. And naturally, those killings have struck at the heart of Israeli fears. Fears generated from centuries of persecution. And at this distance, we may understand this. We are not involved. We haven't lost a member of our family. We know that the killing of Palestinians will not create peace. It will increase hatred. The British government thought internment in Northern Ireland would get rid of the IRA. It didn't. It recruited for them. Israel rightly condemns the world for remaining silent while millions of their people were annihilated. I think the world has to learn from that. We must not repeat the mistake. We must speak out for justice and mercy and peace. Because right now, Israel is in too much pain to consider peace. It's up to us to insist that it's put on the agenda. And we need, I think, to be very careful about how we internalize accounts of war and grief. Because grief is the same for Israelis and Palestinians. But sometimes we only see one part of the story. And when you see film footage of a funeral service, just like ours, with photographs of the deceased in much happier circumstances, you immediately make an emotional connection with the grief of that family, those people. But we have to remember that a hurried burial during a lull in fighting is just as emotional for the people who are grieving. Hatred will not return a single victim of an atrocity to a grieving family. Hatred will only create more grief, because only love can replace hatred. So let us speak out for peace and reconciliation in the world and do what we can for peace. Amen.